Right? How do you know? Maybe he has money under the mattress. He really says that, right? How can you, Shimon, know that Reuven is only trying to sell? Maybe he's going to drive a taxi tomorrow. You tell me he doesn't have any money to lend, right? Which is Shimon's claim, is that Reuven has no money to lend, so even if he moves there and he has a house there.
Oh, is that?
Right? Okay. That's Shimon's implicit claim. So, right, he says, Shema Moos Twinos Yeshlo. Maybe he has money hidden under the mattress. As the real argument is, you can't know that, right? So you, as a competitor, are not entitled to assume that the other person, or Dilma, right, that is sort of irony, or Dilma Mitzia Eshkach. Maybe Reuven will run across a lottery ticket, and then he'll have money to lend.
Poor choice of language.
I think he was having fun on purpose. Umalo l'shimon b'hadei kavshu Reuven, right? What does Shimon care about the secret fate of Reuven, right? He can't make his own economic decisions based on that, right? That's, you know where that Gemara is from? B'hadei kavshu rachman alamalach, right? That's what Yeshaya tells Chizkiya, that when Chizkiya knows that his son is going to turn out evil, Yeshaya, and so he won't have children. Yeshaya says, the secrets of God are not your business. You have children, and we'll see how they turn out. Right? So that's why I think, you know, he's having fun playing with language here. That's why I think Dilma Mitzia Eshkach is also fun. Because at this point, he switched to fun. Yes, Avi?
Why are they making fun of Mari so much?
Making fun of?
Calling out his rhetoric, what could be perceived as large.
I think we should understand what he's doing. And I think this is, I think the language, the Hadei Kavshe, is obviously deliberate rhetoric. You're supposed to appreciate it. Right? I think Dilma Mitzia Eshkach is probably deliberate irony. Right? I think that's probably, he's entitled to have fun when he's writing a tshuva. I think one is entitled to have fun writing a tshuva.
The rabbinic right to have fun.
The right to humorous experience. Right to fun experience.
The right to humorous experience.
I don't know. It's like, yes, there are things in here which are like funny little jokes in the language, but Brodsky is making serious
arguments. He is. He's making very serious arguments, although not. I think the main thing is to get over it is that the thrust of the arguments is always to create more regulation against to create interference with competition. And some of the arguments are stronger than others, and they all tend the same direction. So it's worth asking why. Right, why does he feel so strongly about this? And the distinctions are not always rigorously formulated in ways that are apparent to us. They seem to be creating space for Isser, often. I think that's fair also. Okay, so then he has one last line, which I think, right, the last bolded paragraph, which I think may, in some sense, be a key to what is happening here. So he says, "Vasher kasafta ki ein lo l'shimon l'hamtinat sheyashir Reuven." So I don't know. We went from Toen Shimon to Asher kasafta. So it seems like, right, the Vasher kasafta ki ein lo l'shimon l'hamtinat sheyashir Reuven. What does that tell you is going on here?
Shimon.
Ve'vesaraya. Who's he talking to?
Shaul.
No. Yes, but who's the Shaul?
Rabbi.
Another rabbi. Okay, Shimon hired. All right, Shimon has Shimon has a lawyer.
Or Shimon is a tzurgan.
Shimon has a lawyer. So this tshuva is not a psak din to somebody who asked an objective, innocent question: what do I do? This is a response to somebody who had a rabbi writing in support of him. And he's writing the reaction, to the defendant's brief.
Is that unethical?
No, just be aware of what it is. It's going to change the nature of the rhetoric.
That answers the question about the rhetoric.
Yes.
This isn't a Supreme Court judge writing from on high and saying, "I have the right reading of this amendment to the Constitution. You don't matter. If I need to convince you, I need to convince you, Shimon, that you're wrong. I'm giving you five reasons that you're wrong."
So we don't know under right. If we go back to the original question, right? He just gives you a headline, and he tells you what both sides said, but he doesn't tell you at the very beginning who he's writing to, and what the figures are. But it sounds like we now know that what's going on is that Reuven sued Shimon. Shimon produced a rabbinic opinion supporting him. Right? But Reuven didn't accept the rabbinic opinion supporting Shimon, so Reuven appealed to the Marik, but the question is, why does Marik have jurisdiction?
I don't.
I don't know so much. Yes, Elliot, then Ish.
I just have a question about why you were saying that Shimon seduced the rabbi who has his opinion.
Because Shimon got the rabbi to write to the Marik.
Reuben,
I say.
Reuben. Reuben and Shimon could have gone to Beit Din. And that Beit Din ruled in favor of Shimon.
Yeah.
And then Reuben got pissed and appealed. And that Shimon didn't actually bribe some rabbis. So
I know bribe. Bribe is not a term, but Shimon. The letter to the
language that produced and had hired a lawyer. You
okay, you're right. That's the same point as Avi's making that I'm having too much fun creating images of bias. Yeah. The Marik doesn't respond to anyone who wrote in favor of Reuven. What he says at the very end, what he gives away, is that he's responding to somebody who seems to have decided clearly in favor of Shimon.
Yeah.
And he is seeking to overrule that person.
I agree.
Right. I think that is the, and that I think explains right that the thrust of this case right is not to write an essay. The thrust of this is to, in this case, to provide grounds for rejecting the rabbinic opinion that supported Shimon.
Any possible hypothetical?
Yes.
Future.
With no way out. Okay. Right. No way out. Yes, Avi. And then yes, sorry. I promised you before. Okay, Avi, go.
Okay. Just to harp on the point. Once he's not taking a position of a Dayan, taking a position of someone who is a Dayan, then having multiple arguments is only a sign of weakness in that he's writing from a position of weakness. It's not that my arguments aren't good and I'm not confident in them. It's that I need one of them to get into. If I were to make one strong argument, you could come back at me with one other strong argument and you'd be fine. I need to make five strong arguments to have multiple layers of armor. And then you need to get through all of them in order to prove me wrong.
Could be. If you see, again, I don't know what his position is. That's part of the, we don't know if he's writing as the judge that everybody accepts, as right if he's writing the brief for the brief for Reuven that'll and somehow both briefs will go up to get another Dayan. If Shimon's just this person really honest and he says, look, I know I have this one rabbi supporting me, but I want to make sure everyone supports me. Right, we really don't know. But what we do know now is that this is not an essay that was sitting on the shelf that he just threw in. Right, this is a response in a particular case to somebody ruling the other way. All right, yes, Yesh.
I'm saying I would assume I can't assume well enough because I don't know how the rabbinic situation worked with the Ma'arik, but what we should be able to find is other choose and find out. Because what happens nowadays very often is that they'll have a Beis Din, they'll have a tentative psak, and they'll send it off to this is half the
Yeah, it could very well be that
they send it off for a haskama, and he'll either agree or disagree.
Yes, it could very well be.
I don't know why you were assuming necessarily that this is someone who's in support of Shimon because they're in support of Shimon. Maybe they're in support of Shimon because they're the rav of the town, and the rav says, I wanted to get the Ma'arik's opinion on this just to be safe, and the Ma'arik comes back saying, you're wrong.
It's by sure kasafta ke'ena l'Shimon sounds like he was sent a conclusion to me.
I mean, he was sent a conclusion. Do you agree?
Okay. That could be
usually someone has a tentative conclusion.
Okay, I'm okay
also,
with that too.
I would think part of the reason, presumably, that we're working so hard to fit this in with Rabbi Tam is because the rabbi who's sending the shiloh is claiming that Shimon has rights as to what Rabbi Tam says, and therefore he's either strong or going to win, and so the Marik has to get him out of this Rabbi Tam is defending Shimon.
Yes. No, I think when we go back, we'll see that the language, that there are responses built in. If you look on the second page, it says, V'ulam ki rasita li yashev loshen Mordechai v'davar she'in bo tam klal be'emet. That's pretty strong also. Right? And there's lots of this, right? Tana shel hevel, right? This is very, right? This is strong language. On the other hand, rabbis often use strong language. It doesn't mean animus. Yes?
I just don't think this rules out the fact that this is like a shita, that he was looking for an opportunity to publish.
Okay.
As like it still, I think, is important to say that Ma'arik strongly believes in a complete limitation, as big as limitations of competition as possible.
I'm okay taking that position, but I do want to read the last paragraph of the last bolded thing on the page, where he says, "Ve'od afilu yaver Eliyahu, v'yomar she'en yado maseget lahafik ritzono." Right. So the claim was, you wrote that look, Reuven can't do it now. And you're going to close off this whole field of competition, right? This is basically the problem with monopolies, right? One of the problems with monopolies is that they can be wasted, right? That they can end up not serving the public good, right? And right, they're inefficient, Right? Even if you say that it's efficient for the Jewish community to right not to have competition to lend money to non-Jews because we're wasting our energy, but the risk is that we have a schlump who doesn't right who just buys the opportunity and then doesn't use it. Now it's against the community's interest. Right? So the argument is, you shouldn't have to wait. Right? And that's a good efficiency argument. Right? Why should you be allowed, right? Same as taxi medallions, this is what happened in New York, right? You have people who own medallions. Why do they own medallions? Because they want to resell them. And there are fewer taxis on the street. They have no interest in running taxis. Right? They're just hoping somebody else will want to run a taxi. And they can sell them. And this very often happens in monopolistic circumstances, that people buy up monopoly rights as investments, waiting for someone else to want it badly enough, and then they have an exclusive. So right, why should we permit this? So in the end he says, V'oda, filo yov Eliyahu, v'yomar she'en yado maseget lafik ritzono. Eliyahu comes, and now we have prophetic certainty that Reuven will never be able to use this license. Right? He can't drive. He'll never learn how to drive. Vision is too bad. Mihu zev ezehu, she'yomar b'shvil kach yuchrach l'hikanes chavirot tachtav. Right? Who says that because he'll never get his will, that he is obligated to bring his friend in to replace him? Now that's a pretty interesting argument, right? V'gam lo yuchal l'mchod b'yado v'nilvo b'gvulo. All right, so all of a sudden we have turned into a man's license as his castle. All right, that's right. This is his rhetoric, right? You know, okay, he owns it. Right, he owns the license. He's never going to use it. So what? He's never going to use it. That means that if you walk into his kitchen, he can't say get out. So to me, that is the line. Probably, right? That is the line. Probably. Which in the end is what drives Marik completely. If I were looking for the fulcrum or the Archimedean point, it's that he's just not willing to tolerate it in the end. Yes.
How much do you think this line is working off of the fact that he rented a physical booth? Meaning, how much is this about competition? How much of this is about the question of are you renting the right to lend money, or are you renting a physical area? And plus the right to lend money, and even if you lose the right to one, you don't lose the right to one.
I don't know. I don't think Shimon has the right. Reuven's claim is that now I have rented a house. So Shimon, tell Shimon, you can't have Reuven's house, but you can rent a different house and lend money there.
When we say rented a house, do we mean he rented a house to move there to be able to operate his stall, or are we talking about actually the house being?
Well, I think in the rhetoric, he rented a house to move there. I think that's the point.
Right, but he still has the chanus or whatever exactly it is.
That's right. So why? Why doesn't Shimon just open a different one? Mm-hmm. Shimon's response to Marik should be, "I won't use the house he rented. I'll rent a different one."
Are you sure we're not saying that?
Yeah, I don't think. I think Marik says he can't go in. I think this is Marik's point all the way. Shimon says he's never going to use it. Right? Let me have. Right? Why should his license matter if he's never going to use it? And the Marik says that you can't have it just because he's never going to use it. Doesn't mean it's not his. I think that's what Marik's arguing.
When we talk about love, that's the metaphor.
Yeah, I think it's a metaphor. That's why I said I think it's a man's license is his castle, and that's a very strange argument to me. And it seems to me that Marik is really, and this is where I would agree with Toba, Marik is just really doesn't like the notion of competition with existing people, with existing things, because he thinks you own what you have. Really do you really own what you have? I think that's his underlying thing. Yes, Joshua.
Might be saying that the first person just has all the right in the world to fight back with everything they have.
Well, he's the everything the person has.
We're going to say, the second person is coming to take it.
Yeah.
And, if I am diving onto Paya,
yeah,
and you are taking me away from my Paya, I can fight you back with everything I've got to keep my Paya.
Right, but here, the first tactic he has is a restraining order. Right, so that's what I don't think the Marik's trying to say, oh, you know what? But Reuven can still compete, because the point is Reuven can't compete. He doesn't. Right. I think at the end we learn clearly that Reuven doesn't have any money. Right. That's right. Reuven made a bad investment. Right. And we could construct the tearjerker, right, where Reuven took all his family savings and put it into money lending, which is the only thing Jews can do after all. Right. And then it turned out, Nebuch, that Reuven didn't think really clearly, and he invested so much money in this opportunity, which he doesn't have the opportunity to capitalize. And what the Marik really thinks should happen is that Shimon should lend Reuven the money. interest-free. So that Reuven gets to work, because Shimon has money. Reuven has an opportunity, so why shouldn't Shimon lend Reuven the money? But instead, Shimon says, ha, he doesn't have money. I shall go take his business. Right, so we could, you know, it could be that what's driving Marik in here, right, is that fundamentally you have a clash between a rich and a poor person, and you have an aneh who certainly is being mahapech becharara, he just isn't succeeding. He just, you know, it's just the charara is being held on a string in front of his nose, so he's never going to get it, but he's still trying, right? That's an interesting moral question, if, right, if you have a donkey with a carrot in front of his nose and it's never going to get it, it's just cruel to eat the carrot in front of him. Could be. All right. So much for the Marik. Now we get to the Marshal.
Sorry, just the ending.
Yeah.
I like was just a little bit confused about what his conclusion actually was. Whether you have to what? Like this whole thing about.
Yeah, in the end is he says that at the. The last thing is, even if Shimon had no right to go in, but maybe Reuven can't kick him out.
Right.
So in the end, he argues, nope, you can kick him out too.
Wait, where's...
The last, I didn't bold it. Mm-hmm. Right, he wrote, even if we compare him to Ani Mahapik Becharora, mm-hmm. Ani Mahapik Becharora is only Russia and not Motsian, says, that's true, but this is not just Ani Mahapik Becharora. This is, right, right, but there are other reasons to kick him out. Because this is worse than Imhapik Becharora. This is also, as you said, this is also the Mavoi case. Okay. Marshal comes in, so we're going to start off saying that Marshal begins by sets out a taxonomy, but it's not actually how he begins. Really, this taxonomy appears in the middle of the tshuva. So we're reading the taxonomy first. And then we're going to read the question, and you're going to think about, well, if I had this taxonomy and this question, what would I answer? And then tomorrow we'll read what he actually answers. Okay? So his taxonomy is that there are four categories of, I guess what Rejachter ends up calling interloping behavior. Right? One is Hefker or Metzia, and he says Hefker or Metzia is completely mutter. Okay, there are no restrictions when it comes to Hefker or Metzia. Then he has a category which does not at all clear how to parse it, and we'll have to look at it and see what he says. He calls it Davar She'eno Hefker V'Dome L'Metzia. That's a weird category. It's not at all clear what the language means. And that is a category which he says you're called a Russia, and we publicize in Beit Din you're a Russia, but that's it. Okay, so the first thing, there is no moral opprobrium at all. The second is a category of public moral opprobrium. The third is, if it's imudavar shetarachbo, kigon ani sheminakif barosh hazayit, azu gazlan midivrehem ben yotzeis b'dayanim. Okay, so this is a category worse than being a Russia, it seems, but still not reversible in court. Now that may mean that you can exercise prior restraint. Whereas, to be called a Russia, you can't even exercise prior restraints. Otherwise, it's not at all clear what the difference is between Nikra Russia and Gazal Medivrayim. So, I'm going to set out as an initial hypothetical that you can go to court and stop him from taking it. Of course, in the actual case, it's not, you know, you're standing on top of an olive tree. It's not so likely you can actually go to court unless you have a group of other rabbis climbing the olive tree next door. Beit Din treehouse. Yeah. I don't really otherwise know the reality. It's also not clear how this does this category davar shetarach bo lichora. These are not sequential categories, because davar shetarach bo applies even to something which is hefker, because the ani menachkev rosh hazayit is in a hefker olive tree. It's increasing severity,
but the fourth one supersedes,
right. But the cases overlap, is my point, right? Is that there's Hefker Mesia, there's Hefker Domel Mesia, and then there's, no matter what, if it's Tircha. Right? So the categories aren't right. So suddenly you have the hierarchical categories, you think that there's going to be a smooth Venn diagram. But it's not really, right? This is a... Right? Okay. And then his last category is Davar HaMizuman Etzlo. Kigon Dagi Mithyagana Vachavera Yorit Tokum Naso Havi Kain Gazlan Vachavera Yachol Akevalov Bidin Vladunalov. So that sounds like that makes it sound like the previous case doesn't have any prior restraint. So maybe he's just putting in two categories of moral opprobrium. One is Russia and the other is Gazlan. But they're both just moral opprobrium. I don't know. Yes?
Is Enya Dianim mean...
not reversible.
Extrajudicial? Or does it mean like in contempt of the court?
No, I mean Enya Dianim means that you can't go to court and have the judges remove it to give it back to you.
Okay.
All right, it's not reversible. Okay, then he gives names to them. The first one is Hefker Metzia, the second is Harara, the third is Tircha, the fourth is Umnasa Bekach. Yes, Yaku. Well, it doesn't even say Kain Gazlan is reversible. It says Kain Gazlan is restrainable.
Okay,
right? But maybe Vidulov also means reversible. Maybe.
So wouldn't Kain Gazlan, if it's restrainable, shouldn't Gazlan become more so
maybe? Yeah, of course a real Gazlan you can do.
Right, but he says that's not true.
It says Gazlan. Yeah, but a Gazlan is not a real Gazlan. A Gazlan Midivraim is only rabbinic Gazlan.
And Kain Gazlan is less
worse than a rabbinic Gazlan.
But not a
Deraisa Gazlan.
Is it like Necro-Gazlan?
Yeah, I don't know. It looks like a nice, neat categories, but the middle two categories, if they're both just moral categories, so you know they call you bad and worse, is not so useful. And you're right, we move from Gazlan Medivraim to Ga'en Gazlan. Right, that also is a weakness. And again, we will fundamentally note that nobody really seems to have a makor here, which is why everybody talks about Hasagas Gvul. Because nobody really has a pasuk that they can attach this to, right? One person came up with a nice al shol v'al beit adamim for yorid lunato and asher timed eshet rehu, right? That's also really bad. But I think at the end of the day, we're not really going to claim that this is adultery. Yes, Avi.
Are we definitely moral opprobrium?
Okay, what's the source of the moral opprobrium?
That he got up in shul and said you're a horrible person.
Yes, but on what basis are we saying you're a horrible person?
Obviously.
Obvious. Moral intuition.
What does that mean, moral intuition?
I don't know. Now we're having a finely nuanced moral intuition.
Right. The sources of the Gemara.
What's
the problem with that?
And where did the Gemara come from? Okay.
Isn't Tarahu considered a better guy than...
Yes. So this is, right. So we have a moral svara in some way. And it's, again, I think, is when you develop nuanced morals, right? Moral intuitions. That's a little complicated.
I don't know. Somebody gets up in shul and says the butcher is a Russia. You gonna go to the butcher?
Somebody gets up in shul and says the butcher is a Russia, and somebody else gets up and says, right? The first thing gets in shul is the butcher is that butcher is a Russia. The second person says, yeah, well that butcher is a Gazlan Midivraim. <Yeah. laughs> The third person says, ha, but he's Cain Gazlan.
So,
with
no meat.
I think we could then have our whole other thing. No, he's not really right. Is he right? What kind of Russia is he? And we'll start splitting the category of Russia. But none of these are going to have any real moral legal implications. We're just debating about how bad a person he is.
It's like the
Tanya. Benonim Rishayim. Benonim. I am suspicious of formalized, nuanced moral intuition. Okay. That's just me. Okay. So the first category, she calls Metzia the Hefker. So he tells you up front, which is nice, Lav Dafka Shayamamish Hefker and Metzia. Right? Only thing, and that's why I don't understand the previous category, right? He says, Ella Kol Shadomila Metzia. Right? And his riot for this is, hey, there's a Marik. Right, and he reframes the Marik's category. His category is Zul HaMevurer, as opposed to Zul She'ena Mevurer Klal. Right, and he makes the argument. You have to say this. Ilotei Mahachi in Kain B'Shum Schora Lo Yeshayech Bodinanei Mahapech Becharora Derov Schora Shadam Kona B'Zul Kedei LaHaviach Ba. Right, so here's right. So here is why he sort of inverts my argument. What he says is, it seems pretty clear that what Hefker Metzia means is that you don't have to lose. Okay. But then he says, if that's the case, it seems pretty clear that there's that the whole rule, that if Rabbeinu Tam's right, the rule doesn't exist at all. Right? So therefore, right? Therefore, he says, it must be that the rule of Rabbeinu Tam only applies, right? That the rule of Rabbeinu Tam, Hefker Metzia, only applies, Hefker Metzia means that you have a clear gain, because if it didn't mean you have a clear gain, then Rabbeinu Tam would have the effect of eviscerating Ani Mehapek Becharor. Right, and that essentially is what is the argument that Ma'arik takes. Ma'arik says that Rabbeinu Tam goes too far if you take him literally, so we have to narrow Rabbeinu Tam. So he makes the argument explicitly, right? He says, "Im lo te mahachi, if you weren't going to say this, im kein b'shum schor liyah shayach b'dinan hapech b'charora, and that can't be. Ani hapech b'charora has to have an application in the world of commerce. Whether he thinks that because otherwise Rabbeinu Tam's distinction is incoherent, or because he just thinks it's intolerable." That there shouldn't be such a thing, I don't know.
Hmm.
Okay, so now he says.
Can be Talta Torah Tani Hamhafek Becharora?
Yes. Yeah. No. That is.
Doesn't mean a big gain, right? It just means.
Well, he uses clear as opposed to big.
Right, but so that's like somewhere in between the Maharik's like definite versus small big. Right.
I don't know what the term means. Mavur Lakol is an ironic term if you're going for clarity. Right, Venir Leinayim, who knows?
We get this Danish, like, in every lesson. It's a pity that no one was didactic in language.
Okay, so then he says, the Marik compares Halvas Ribis in a Chanut to something, the davar she'eno bo kitzva ve'eno vur harevach, afal pi she'taluy bo kol mechiasel shel adam begalut zeh, kemo she'kasav ha'gon atzmo b'sof ha'tshuva. Okay, so the Marik said that this is, that lending money is a davar she'eno bo kitzva, you can't be sure that you're losing money by giving up money lending opportunity. And he says, well, I would never argue with Marik. But
what does that mean exactly?
But Rick said that how does, in his case, how does Shimon know, right? Shimon can't be sure that he won't find as good an opportunity everywhere, and therefore, for the Marik, Shimon is in violation of Rabbeinu Tam. Right? He's Ani Mehapech Becharora, because he doesn't know for sure that he will gain by supplanting Reuven. So now, the Marshal says, that's really very good, and I have great deference to the Marik, even though it seems to me that if I hadn't seen the Marik, I would have said, money lending? You're not certain, right? You don't certain gain. That's all we do. If we weren't sure you were getting money, if you were getting money by money lending, we're all starving, right? This is the ultimate umnaso bekach. So, I'm not so convinced by the marshal, but by the Marik. But the Marik said it, says the marshal. But mikol makom nira beinai, dafke binyan ze, shenuchal lamar sheyachol hasheni yeshrasol itchotol tzom amana makom acher rishut macherim, aval mi shelo yachol imso kein ze bemakom acher, afilu ena mevura. Okay, so now he has a qualification of the qualification. So Marik said it's only right that you can only get away with it if you're sure you're going to gain. But he says you can get away with it if you're sure that you will not have an opportunity. If you're sure the other way, right? He says that if you're sure that you will not have an opportunity to gain as much, then it's mutter for you. Marik said, unless you can only interfere if you're sure that you will never be able to gain this much. And the Marik completely reverses that. He says, you're allowed to interfere. Marshal says, if you're sure you'll never be able to gain as much. Now, there is a sweet spot in which you can reconcile these positions.
To gain as much?
It says is, right? Im mishlo yuchal imso ke'ein zeh b'makom acher. It's somebody who won't find a similar risk-reward opportunity somewhere. Afilo enem mevura revach fekatsuv. Even if it's not clear.
I took ke'ein zeh as a money-lending job. I didn't necessarily think it was the same.
So let's try it. Let's read it one more time again. Right? It says, see, he's just said, according to the Marik said, that it's still usser if you can't be sure how much money you're going to get. That's basically what the Maharik said. So he says, but my eyes, it's only in this way, she'nuchal lomar, where we could say, she'achol ha'sheni yetzeres l'idchoto, l'hosim amonu b'mokam achar v'yishim achirim. Right, where you can tell Shimon, go spend your money somewhere else. But if you have Shimon, Shimon will not find a similar opportunity somewhere else. Which I think means a similar risk-reward opportunity. Shimon says, you know what? It's true that I don't know how much money I would gain here. But I know that I will not gain an opportunity as good somewhere else. Yeah?
So, I think what he's saying is the consideration of the Maharik that if I don't know exactly how much money I'm going to make, then you could really go anywhere else because you have no way of knowing where you're going to make the most money. Only applies in situations where you have somewhere else to go. But if you don't have anywhere else to go, so that consideration is irrelevant.
Somewhere else to go, but now what are my standards for somewhere else to go? That's what it seems to me, right? The standard he sets up, I think that he eviscerates the Maharik. Right? I think the Maharik tried to basically eliminate this argument by saying it's really not going to apply to business because it only applies where there's certainty of gain. And the Maharshal comes in and says, no, that doesn't make any sense because you never have certainty of gain in business. So it must mean, right? It must mean. That somebody has an equal business opportunity, even though he says the Maharik said
equally uncertain business opportunity.
Yes, so that's what I'm saying. He has to have the same risk reward opportunity somewhere else. Right, that's what the Maharshal says. It's only, we only restrain competition if you don't have an equal risk reward opportunity. I concede to you, Mr. Maharik, Rabbi Maharik, because you're the greatest. But I concede to you that it doesn't have to be I can see to you that he can't say that just Maharik said that you can only compete if the gain is definite, but he defined, right, or if the loss to you would be definite, but he says we have to define the loss to you being definite, we have to include opportunity cost in that calculation. And by putting opportunity cost back in, right, he basically makes the Maharik's distinction irrelevant. I think that's essentially
I'm
the.
Not getting some of the terminology is. Not,
yes, I'm trying to.
Not helping me understand.
So let's try this again. So, Reuven possesses this opportunity. Shimon, right? I just read Reuven and Tom. Right? Let's say Reuven has a bank, and we know that right now the odds are next year there's a 50% chance it loses $10 and a 50% chance it gains $100. Okay,
uncertainty.
Yes, it's uncertainty. So the Maharik says, Shimon can't compete because he doesn't know he'll make money.
Because he has other places to go where he...
Because the other places...
The idea is that for the Maharik is that uncertainty is equal everywhere. So if you're equally uncertain everywhere, you could just...
That's right. And then the Maharshal comes in and says, uncertainty isn't equal everywhere. I can evaluate how much this is worth, right, by figuring out what the risk-reward ratio is. And to tell me that I have the opportunity to spend my money elsewhere... Really, you have to tell me that I have the opportunity to spend my money elsewhere in a way which would be equally, right, which would have the same risk-reward ratio.
I don't see any of that in his text, though.
Limso ke'ein zeb makom acher, afila nevura harevech ve'akatsu. You know, the other place also doesn't have certainty.
Right, because there is another, I think the idea is that if you have another opportunity, then all uncertainties are equal. But if you don't have another opportunity, you got to take the uncertainty that you have.
All uncertainties are equal? Right, so he's going to claim that, right, so all uncertainties are equal. You think he accepts that all certainties are equal. So I wouldn't be allowed to compete, even if in Reuven's business, which I'm trying to compete with, there's a 10% chance of loss and a 90% chance of gain. And whereas in this open space, there's a 90% chance of loss.
I agree with your logic, I just don't think I see it in the Maharshal.
Ah, okay, well, so let me go back to the question of whether it's just plausible. Okay, we've got only 15 minutes left, so I gotta take us through. Okay, so then he goes through the, right, he has a wonderful flourish of Matov Manoyim Shevesachim, right, which is for his vision of, you know, of a happy, competitive Jewish, right, Jewish community. Why should we wish to restrain people? Let's all live and compete, and compete together. Yes. Okay. So much for his first category. His second category, shame. Right. So what Marshall is in the first category is. He says that, you know what, I think there is some space for competition and the Marik tried to close off and I'm going to reopen it. Second category, Mahapik Becharara. And he said, well, we already saw the din was only the Krosa to Russia, not to be done alive. And if your friend comes, he's Nikra Russia. Obviously, right, and then he said, interesting line, Kalvachomer, imivatil mekho shel chavero chotevlo lo. If you just mess up somebody else's deal, not to get your own, right, so you don't even benefit out of it, so that's just mean. But now he says, So now he just totally undermines the distinction between moral and legal reactions. Because he says, you know what? A moral reaction is a floor. Nikra Russia means that, well, we can call you Russia if that's all we want to do. Or we can take away your money if we want to. So we haven't seen it. That's back in his Shuvah. But he's right.
Okay, but we'll see it.
You'll see it. Right, you'll see it. He will quote a Rambam. The Psak is that the Rambam. I think the Psak is talking about the Rambam says that in the Peah case, not only do we let the other guy compete, we take it away from the first guy. So. The second category turns out not to be so clear at all, because he can explain away any case which is in this category in which the Beit Din actually takes the money away by saying, yeah, that's not the halacha, the Beit Din just decided that. All right, so you have to be careful of what this does. On the one hand, it radically expands the category of Beit Din's authority, because basically it says whenever you can call Marusha, you can do whatever you want. On the other hand, it opens up interpretational flexibility. Because any time somebody tries to use a case where Beit Din took something away as precedent, he can say, that's just Nikra Russia, and the Beit Din chose to enforce something worse. Right, so that opens up an enormous amount of space. Okay, category three, right, is Tircha, but we discover somewhere in the middle that, right, if you look at the bullets, Tircha manu l'chalek ben Tircha l'Tircha. It's not always Tircha, there's Tircha type A and Tircha type B. Tircha type A, right, makes you a gazlam edivrayim. Tircha type B is irrelevant. Yeah, okay. So, right, and the only way you can tell the difference between Tircha type A and Tircha type B is by the outcome in the case of the Gemara. So we can have arguments about any given circumstance, whether it's Tircha type A and...
This is like SDP in the Supreme Court.
SDP?
Substance due process. If it happened, then it was substantive due process.
Well,
it's
well, he tries to make it look good, right?
Uh-huh.
Can't really. There's not going
to... And he has a whole list, right? He has the list of, you know, the Tircha of Zesim is particularly special because you risk your life.
That's the way the Gemara describes the way that people make money with physical labor.
Yes.
Climbing up trees.
Right, no, I think
that's... And maybe having to walk a long way, that's also Tircha... And then he has to figure out, but fishing is his big one, right? Because he has to make fish, right? This is everyone's problem, is that fishing is the place where Tosafot introduces the distinction of Tircha. So you have to find a way, right? If you want any case to be okay, despite, you know, any kind of Tircha not to trigger the legal response of Marchikin, you have to claim this is less Tircha than it took to set up a fish trap. The problem is, we don't know how well there's a minute to set up a fish trap.
It's not about the olive tree?
No, the olive tree gets you Gezel Minivrayim, but the fish trap gets you Marchikin.
Which the Maharshal assumes
prior restraint.
Is the Kuva prior, is not just prior restraint, but also you can stop them.
Yes. So,
which is I think has been unstated.
Okay.
Like, you know, this is, I think, the earliest
source. Okay. A fundamental problem is, it sounds like fish trapping is a more serious issue than climbing an olive tree and shaking things off. Because climbing an olive tree and shaking things off is only Gezel Medivrayim, and fish trapping gets you prior restraint. And it's really hard to think how that is. So we end up making distinctions that are largely not predictive principles.
Maybe you have to give back the fish after you've already fished them.
Depends how big the fish is.
They're not trying to do predictive principles. They're trying to
okay.
have a way to read everything.
Into you have your agenda. They have theirs. Yes.
Well, it's not priors. It's not one as strong, it's just a very different scenario.
No, the fish case, you can stop the, say the other guy, you're not allowed to do this.
But there's no... presumably, if one planted a olive tree, then you could get prior restraint.
They didn't plant an olive tree. There's a Hefker olive tree.
What I'm saying is that the same way by fishing,
yeah.
he prepared a trap and he... and that's why you're allowed to get prior restraint.
No, because the olive tree, the olive tree is the water, and the fish are the olives, and the setting the trap is like climbing the tree.
Maybe setting fishnets was dangerous back in the day.
Maybe setting fishnets was dangerous. Killer whales. Think of it. If you play the analogy out, it's not going to work. Okay, and this fourth category is umnasa b'kach, and that he has nothing particular. To say about for our purposes. And then he tells you, we're turning the page, and he says, you know, I don't want to talk about all this because the Marik already got it all right. And it's not part of this question. And then he says, and then there's Marufya. And nowadays he thinks that there's no possibility of a case of Marufya. By his time, in the 16th century, Marufya is over, and nobody should try to bring Marufya in. Okay. Those are the Marik's classifications, right? So he has four classifications. He tells category one, I think, undoes the Marik's constriction of Anim Hapech Bekarara. Category one, right, undoes Marik's constriction or Ben Tam's constriction of Anim Hapech Bekarara. So it re-expands. It re-expands it re-shrinks. Right, shrinks, right? Aliyah Avchara in the Gemara, Rashi applies to everything, Rabbeinu Tam narrows it, the Marik expands it out again, and the Marshal brings it back in. Right, it reconstricts it.
The Marik narrows Rabbeinu Tam, and the Marshal expands Rabbeinu Tam.
Yeah, the Marshal, Rabbeinu Tam narrows the Gemara, the Marik narrows Rabbeinu Tam's narrowing of the Gemara, and the Marshal narrows the Marik's narrowing of Tom's narrowing of the Gemara.
And the Maharshal does what?
He narrows the Marik's narrowing of Tom's narrowing of the Gemara.
How did I not get that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I don't know if using the same
grid
for all these things is actually helpful.
Oh, but it's fun.
All right.
So I'm used to it. That's why you just said about
anti-disestablishmentarianism. I have a capitalistic way of framing it. Just what we needed.
What is the narrowing is the limit on competition.
So the Gemara sounds like they're right. You just can't compete because it's Gemara only happy for Carrara. Rabbeinu Tam says, sure you compete as long as it's not a mitzvah.
Right.
The Marik says, yeah, but just about
everything
but
good.
Just about nothing is a mitzvah.
Right.
And the Marashal says, well, no. Right? Actually, lots of things that are mitzvahs. Then the second thing he does is he undoes the distinction based on consequences. You would have thought that we could identify which category something fell into by whether the response is legal or just moral opprobrium. But he says no, because actually, whenever the response is moral opprobrium, the courts can do whatever they want. It's only a floor, not a ceiling. So on the one hand, he increases the severity of every case by saying any case where there's any moral opprobrium, we can do anything we want to you. And on the other hand, he undermines our capacity to tell which category something fits into by the outcome, because even if there's a legal response, it doesn't mean that it's the category which requires a legal response. It might just mean that for whatever reason, the rabbis wanted to respond in that case.
Do you call it moral opprobrium?
Moral opprobrium. Opprobrium. Look it up. Okay. So now we get to the Shiloh. Right, the Shiloh was asked to the...
Can we, like, fix the Maharshal? has some goal here or something.
I don't want you to know yet. I just tell you his classification so that you have that in advance, and then I'll learn the case, and then you can predict for yourself what he's going to say, and then you'll see what he says. It takes him a long time to say it. But.
He's just given himself license.
That might be. Might be. He's created. So look, I'm fine, right? That's what I try and show you all over there, right? Is how much discretion you have if you look for it. Right. The whole purpose of Shir is to maximize your discretion.
No, well, if the Maharshal can do that.
Yes.
And he's done that.
Yes.
So now we can do
it. I don't think it's necessarily good to teach us.
Let's figure it then. Hopefully you are humbled and matured by power. Okay. This is the give people nuclear weapons and then they will right and then they'll constructively engage the world.
Right. This is something
I think you should have done. That may not have been the most useful analogy for pedagogy. All right.
No, but it's a metaphor I use.
I think it's how the rabbis function. I think it's the awareness of their power is what drives them to constantly restrict it.
Oh, that explains so much about the way that rabbis use power right now.
We'll try. Okay, here's the case. Reuven Tava et Shimon. Right, so if he tells you, right, this is the tshuva that he wrote when he was very young, and they give you the reference. Right, on a Maisa Vasagas Gvul. And this is the framing of...
I'm looking at the
Yamshel Shlomo. Great, but... Right, this, which he tells you is parallel to the to Shuvat Lamed Hey Lamed Hey Lamed Vov. Right. So, but the first thing we see is right. So, hold that and hold Shuvat Marshal Lamed Hey, which is three pages later open, right in your packets. You have them side by side. Okay. Here's the first maddening thing where you can tell that these are not actually copied one from the other, because they switch names. Right. The Yamshel Shlomo copies it as Reuven Tava et Shimon. And the Shuvat Marshal says Shimon Tova et Reuven.
Can you just tell us where what these books are, if they're the same person?
They're the same person.
But was one collected from his students, or were they both
published? I don't know, but in this case, the Yamshel Shlomo says, look, this is what I wrote earlier, so it's clear the Yamshel Shlomo version comes later.
Okay.
And it's consistent, by the way. All the Reuven and Shimons are properly reversed.
Can we just do a
control F
replace?
Maybe they wanted to make it clear that it doesn't actually matter what the person's name is.
That could actually be like a manuscript change, right? Meaning
it could be there are two copies.
If it's written out Aleph and Bet, and then someone decided to expand Aleph into Reuven and the other to Shimon, and the person who published the other book decided to expand Aleph into Shimon and Bet into Reuven.
I guess that could be.
But that does happen with change orders from Reuven to Shimon.
It could be. I assume that it actually meant there were actually two copies. And he rewrote it a little bit. I don't know. Okay, so the case involves there's A, all right, who's either Reuven or Shimon, depending on which version you're in. We'll call it we shall replace the Toain with A and the Nidva and Nidva with B. So A buys a license to sell whiskey from some town, right? From some town people. He gets an exclusive license. It's for a period of time. At some point, right? He does not engage in early negotiations to renew the license. B comes in, and takes the next stage of the license. Right, he prevents the renewal of the license. He interferes, and he comes in. Now, he claims that he was called in by the by the town elders, and they asked him to bid on the renewal of the contract. So it wasn't his idea. He knew that A had the contract, but A had not been engaging in negotiations to renew it, possibly because he assumed it would be renewed. And B says, you know what? The town people called me in, and they asked me to bid. But then it gets messy, because then the town council that asked B to bid, and accepted his bid and took his money, then asked, can you please give me that piece of paper again? And then they refused to give it back until he bribed them. Right,
until
B bribed them. So they accepted, right? So they accepted his bid on the license, but they refused to publicize it.
It's a very, very shrewd town council.
Yes, but then B goes and complains to the queen.
No, she's the queen of England.
Who's England?
I don't think so.
London also.
Is it mentioned London?
I think. Which is crazy, because there are no Jews in England.
Yeah.
There are no Jews in
London. I would have thought that this was Austria or something.
Yeah,
where did you
see
London?
Yeah.
Lunda. You can read it as Ladina, as Ladana or London.
I'm with Josh.
Also, this is when Queen Elizabeth I was reigning.
Wait, we have to find out if there are queens anywhere else.
Okay, now if you take a look, if you have the two in hand, you'll see where I start underlining. Where I start underlining in the version that they shoot Marshal Lamed Hay. Right, so you'll see that the whole underlined section doesn't exist in the version in the Yamshel Shlomo, and there's a pretty clear reason why. Because the two words before the underlined section and the last two words of the underlined section are the same. They both hit strain of him. So the copyist.
How long is that?
Six lines.
Skip the whole paragraph by accident?
Yeah.
Is that
really
common?
Yes.
Or was that intentional?
No, no. It happens. And the most famous example of this is in the Yerushalmi. The printed Yerushalmi has the same half amud twice. Because you skip backwards too.
The Bifnei Kahal Veda?
Where?
Oops.
I don't know where it is. But the thing about the Yerushalmi is we have the manuscript it was printed from.
What are the lines that the Gemara...
Right, so we know that they're not printing the manuscript. We know that there was an error between the manuscript because...
Are all of your underlined lines things that were missed?
No. Well, yeah, they're often differences.
Which are the underlying lines?
It says, Bishnei Kalveda.
Yeah.
Yeah, but that's it. The Yerushalmi is the famous example because the same Amud appears twice. And we know that it wasn't the printer copying a manuscript that had that error because we have the manuscript that it was printed from because they put it down on the printing press. So you can on the manuscript on the back you can see the printed Yerushalmi. So we know, right? So we know it's the right one. At least that's what I was told. So people have these are typos happen everywhere. Okay. So in this case, so there's a whole right. So then they have all sorts of fights about when right, when things were bought. There are other types of typos which you can see, right, that it's the price is 100 zikukim in one of them and pay shuk in the other. And a shuk is not a coin that I'm aware of. So if that sounds like somebody you know, has a typo there. The typo is the other way around. Okay, there was an attempt at compromise which was turned down. Okay. Now here is the if you turn now to the I think we're three lines to the end of the packet, the page that begins the Hakasav Hasmag, the Chronon Livracha.
In the
Shit Marshal.
Sorry, say that again.
The page on top says the Hakasav Hasmagzal. Three lines to the end of the packet. Yeah. So what he's been doing is do I want to start that? Where do I want to start? Let's start one page earlier, actually, right? What the page that says on top of Od Hisreinu. So there's a paragraph break in the middle, and then the third paragraph begins Vinei Osam Shnei Hatzadim Nis Amsul Adin Lifle Ploni Almoni Echad After Huchsak Lehora. So they both decided to go to court in front of this unnamed person. Who was muchzak l'hora? Who yidon v'adin yikov v'har? Right? They signed the binding arbitration agreement. And the beginning of this arbitration agreement, Reuven A said to him, "You know, you don't really want to do this by yourself. You want to bring other people in." And B said, "Nah, do it by yourself. Maybe you want to save money on the cost, right? The cost per hour of the judges." And the judge decided, "You know what? I'll do it by myself." Okay, and then right, there's a whole long discussion then in the Marshal, but the bottom line of it is he thinks the judge blew it by handling it by himself because you should never judge a monetary case by yourself, even if both sides agree. And Then he says that Hinei Otter, right, for the next page, he says Hinei Oseho Moreh, that's the paragraph that begins in the middle of the page. Pasak Shashimon Anel Yachizik Hayayin Sarap and Mekach Ashrakana Ruvain. Kiyesh Lamaranda Gluya. So the second guy, right, so this Moreh holds that Shimon in this version is A, right? A gets to keep the money, even though B spent a lot of money to bribe the judges to switch it to him. And he says that there's a repayment. As a whole, right? And everything goes to the guy who had it first. Okay, now here he has a funny. If you look at the underlying section, he says. Reuven told me about this psak that Shimon gets to keep everything, and even though Reuven isn't really believed about this, okay. So the judge decided on the basis of a quote from the Rokeach, which said you really should not be masig gvul. You really should not be masig gvul. And if you're masik gvul, that's bad, and we do whatever we want to, right? That's the previous line, right? You take a look, actually, we should go back one paragraph earlier, where the underlined section says, Hevi zahir, velo tasig gvul reecha, velo tikach michiato. Don't do that. And if, v'im kana schora o matbea min ha-shilton, if A bought stuff from the government, v'yavo acher v'yosef kde likach michavero, and the second guy comes in and underprices him, right, or outbids him, zeh lo nitan limchol, you can't forget this, v'nikra rasha, the Ein Gazlan Kamoto, right? So we've gone up, right? We have Gazlan Medivreyev, Ein Gazlan, now we have topped it all. Ein Gazlan Kamoto. Right? He's the worst thief of all. And Reuven comes and tells the Marshal, that's what the judge said. That I'm gonna be put in Cherem. Now he says, look, maybe Reuven's not believed. Because maybe the Mora had another reason, he just quoted that tshuva because it sounded good. So I'm going to try. Alkein basi l'chabesu l'tzadeid zuchut l'oto Mora. I come and I'm trying to find some way to justify that judge. B'ulai meli tziosher echad minei elef yehei imo. Maybe he'll find one position among 1,000 who's a person. V'af shi ein nafkusa kol kach bedin. Even though it won't matter l'halacha, he'll still be dead wrong. Right, even if, right, because Shim Rova Gonim Kinegdo Arehu Tobid Var Mishnah Kasher Ochiach Lekaman. Because if most of the precedents are against him, then he just loses and he's overrulable and his position is reversible. But at least we could find this one person in 1,000 who would have supported this ruling. Mikol Makom, right, Kadeshul Yikalein Bidin Bikare Beitin Toe, because I don't want to embarrass him and call him a mistaken Beitin. We have to find some kind of excuse. But if we engage in comprehensive research and we can't find a single position in history which supported his position, right? The end of the day is, if we can't find a single person who supports his position, well, God found out that he's an idiot. And if it was an accident, it's tough. It's still his fault. Because accidental mistakes in Talmud count as deliberate. Okay, this is not going to be a friendly tshuva. But the question is, can you figure out which way will be unfriendly? What he tells you, right, is that he believes. He believes that that the case in which he gives you is unambiguous. Right? It should be 100% clear what the halakha is. So clear that even though the people went to a different rabbi who gave them a ruling, that he is willing to completely overrule that ruling. And not only that, he's going to overrule that ruling not because the person made a wrong decision in a matter of judgment, but because the person made a decision which at best would be defensible by claiming that he has one precedent out of 1,000 to defend him. And it seems very likely he's going to end up thinking, nope, not even 1 in 1,000. So the question is, what is it about our case, based on his categorization, that could generate that kind of certainty? Which is what he claims, right? He claimed that the case, which seemed like, you know, okay, regular case, is so clear that nobody with brains in their head, and he uses that kind of rhetoric repeatedly in the Shiva, right? Even the smallest of small children understand. that kind of thing. Nobody could possibly reach a different conclusion. So we'll try and figure out why it's so obvious. Okay, last question before I have to go. No? Okay, so we will now break till 4. Can we do that?
Or do you maybe 3:45?
3:45. We'll break till 3:45. The dinner at 5, that's true.
So 3:30, 15 minutes.
3:30, okay. 3:30. I will try to make dinner. Start without me if I'm late.